we've been trained to think of like, oh, you serve 500 seniors, they're less likely to fall and break their leg. And so they save taxpayers money because they don't go to the emergency room. Crime rates have been reduced because hungry seniors are no longer robbing banks. And I'm just like, Jesus, we just help people who are hungry because they are hungry, and we are in community together with one another.
Hey everyone, it's Hildy, and this is the Creating the Future podcast. I'm glad you've joined us here today. This is a place for us to explore what really creates social change. What moves beyond the assumption that change is slow and incremental to create the kind of transformational change that we can see and feel? That is the question driving this podcast. I'm so excited to have two of my favorite rabble-rousers joining me today, Robert Egger and Vu Lay. Robert Egger is a lifelong champion for the power of food to improve the lives of people and their communities. Robert has been the force behind the whole community kitchen movement, having founded the DC Central Kitchen, the Campus Kitchen Project, the LA Kitchen, and been a founding board member of the World Central Kitchen, the group that heads into crisis areas to ensure folks in those desperate situations have food. As for Vu Lay, Vu writes the blog Nonprofit AF, where he uses a combination of humor, biting criticism, and a father's love to encourage change leaders to do better at creating a world that works for all of us. Vu founded and led the Seattle-based RVC, an organization focused on supporting leaders and organizations of color. He also helped found the community-centric fundraising movement, which aims to ground fundraising in equity and justice. And full disclosure, Vu is also an active member of Creating the Future's board of directors. Robert and Vu have both been vocal over the years, both in their criticism and their cheerleading for the work of nonprofits as it relates to creating social change. And so it is my pleasure to welcome Robert Egger and Vu Lay to the podcast today. Hi, everyone. I'm Hildy with Creating the Future. I am here with my really, really good friends, Robert Egger and Vu Lay. And I'm going to start by asking each of you something that is exciting in your life these days. Robert, what's going on in your life these days that's bringing you joy?
Well, being with you again, Hildy, you and I have a great, long, rich, deep history of trying to push that envelope. So it's a joy to see you. You know what gives me great joy? I have dear friends who've been in the music industry for a long time. And, you know, I ran nightclubs before starting DC Kitchen, and many of them have put out new records, and they're vibrant and really great. And particularly my great friend Brendan Canty and Joe Lally, who were in Fugazi, which was kind of a highly regarded punk band, put out a mesmerizing jazz album together. So to see them not only continuing to create, but to see them take big steps in different directions, being brave. Man, nothing's better than seeing friends being brave and succeeding.
That sounds awesome. Now I can't wait to hear it. And how about you, Vu? What's going on in your world?
Hey, Ellie. Hi, Robert. Let me see. I am taking ceramics and making little pots and bowls and things. They're not very good. They're really kind of terrible because I'm learning a new skill. But it's kind of nice to be creatively engaged in something. I'm really excited about pottery.
And getting your hands messy.
It is very messy, and it requires a lot of like strength, upper body strength, which is kind of hard because I'm like a vegan, you know, and I don't have a lot of that. But you gotta squeeze the clay, you gotta mold it. It's challenging.
I bet for your sons, those will be treasured heirlooms. You know? It'll be like, my pop made this. Not unlike the way we all treat the goofy cat your kid made in kindergarten out of clay.
So hopefully it'll be better than the cat that they made, you know. So I'm like, I'm way more skilled than you. But yeah, I'm hoping to leave them something where they could, like, after I pass on, they could use it as a focal point for a college essay or something, like a profound college essay about their father.
I like it. Why my father is like a dinosaur. Yeah, this definitely works. Well, the excitement, in addition to starting this podcast and having both of you be my guests, and the fact that, Robert, you were my first guest for my first podcast back in 2010. So that's exciting.
I remember you just graduated college.
Thank you, both of them.
No, man, but those were heady times, man. 2010. You had the Obama administration in. You had elections with multiple governors running, which was a time in which you may recall I was trying to get the nonprofit sector to really advocate on behalf of itself so that we elected people who were excited about what we contributed. So that was a fun time, man, and I was honored to have that opportunity to be your first guest.
It's always fun to hear what's going on in friends' lives. So thank you. We are going to kick off with the question that I love, which is, when you guys see change happening, and I know both of you are students of change, when you see change happening, what do you see undergirding that change? What are the factors that you see leading to change? Whoever wants to jump in.
No worries.
Okay, we always applied what we lovingly call the Costanza principle, and I think it really works well in that there's a time when you look at what everybody's doing, and you ponder what's working and what isn't, and then you do the opposite of what everybody's doing. When I started DC Kitchen, for example, what you had was a sector that picked a food and dropped it off, didn't market very effectively, didn't do advocacy very effectively. And I was very frustrated by what I encountered as a volunteer who was trying to do something a little bit more profound with food. So my attitude was, I'm just going to do the opposite. I'm not going to give food away. I'm going to use it to train people for jobs. I'm not going to trust the economy. I'm going to create jobs for people. We're going to earn our own money, so we're not going to have to, you know, scrape and bow to foundations as much, which gives us the ability to be a lot more vocal politically. So again, that idea sometimes of just stopping and really saying, you know, if this isn't working, maybe trying something new is the obvious thing, but literally trying the opposite, I think, has some real validity to it.
You know, there's so much of what is going on in the world right now that I am watching movements and change advocates are actually doing. They're jumping in to do the opposite of what we're told.
Yeah, I think about all the students at all these campuses who have been supporting Palestine and having their encampments to try to get their universities to divest from supporting Israel. And I think that's kind of what it takes for change. Oftentimes is this collective anger. I think the students have been angry enough for so long because of how they've been treated. You know, the U.S. government has been not serious at all about addressing school shooting or climate or any of these horrific economic disparities. And I think it's been culminating in this and everything that's been happening here. And I think it's inspiring. And we should be taking some cues from this. Because if we think about a lot of the movements in the past, like with apartheid, with Vietnam, it's a lot of these student-led movements that have been leading change. And I'm really inspired by it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. If we go back and look at the history, we in the nonprofit sector think we are, quote, about social change, but change really happens from movements. Change happens from people.
Yeah. Sorry, Robert, go ahead.
Well, I just think sadly you can make a case. When I was young, man, I had somebody in a shelter was delivering food, you know, like asking me what I was trying to accomplish. And he basically said, you have a choice in life. You can be an agent of the people or a tool of the man. And I laughed at the kind of simplicity of it. But I mean, literally, as I started to stew on it, I really, really fixated on that idea of how do you become an agent of the people versus a tool of the man. And of course, based on the, you know, the false knowledge that we're an independent sector, you know, we are far from independent. We are completely subservient to corporate and corporate philanthropy and foundations. So that idea of, and I really want to riff here for just one second, because being born in 1958 and being 65 now, I really had a front row to a lot of these things, even as a child. But one of the things the Movements had was music. And I know, like, Macklemore put out a song this morning, if I'm not mistaken, about Columbia. But, like, it was just the anniversary of Kent State. And all of us of a certain generation viscerally remember the song Ohio and how fucking rad that was to have an anthem, to have something that really united us. The Clash used to say, let fury have the hour, anger can be power if you know how to use it. And I think that's the struggle for many of my generation, is trying to imagine what's the alternative for young people besides anger. And you've seen it with particularly the gun movement and the young people who've come out of these school shootings that have tried desperately to elect people who will legislate some gun safety. And I think for many of them, it's like that hasn't worked. So to Vu's point, I think they're just up, their backs are up against the wall, and they're reacting just viscerally to this wrong that they see.
I think it's really interesting. I've always thought about what you said about movements, Hildy, when you were writing about it, like sort of like the rise of movements. Maybe we need to kind of shift away from organization-based work, because I think maybe in some ways we've entrenched ourselves and we've become, sometimes we've become part of the problem. I start to wonder about this. I think maybe we need to have some sort of existential crisis in the sector where we need to confront the fact that a lot of the stuff we're doing is in some ways just charity washing and conscience laundering for the inequities that are out there. And it makes it worse in some case, right? Because it gives people this like false sense that something is actually happening. I see large companies, for example, donating some money to nonprofits, and then they get praise for doing that instead of what they should be doing, which is like paying their fair share of taxes and not exploiting
or paying their employees.
Yeah, exactly. Exploiting their workers. So then we're like that. And it's just been alarming over the past few years, just how I think many of us have been pushing against this and calling it out. And the biggest pushback that we get, it's like not from these, from like, you know, like people who are on the opposite end of the ideological spectrum. It's like people on our own side, other fundraising experts and stuff. I've been getting more flack from them than from anyone else, like from people in our own sector saying like, you know, you shouldn't criticize rich people. You shouldn't criticize these institutions. You should go along with it. What can we do? It's like this very white moderate line of thinking. We've entrenched ourselves in it.
You know, this is our sector is the feminized part of the American economy. And to my way of thinking, watching the Supreme Court getting packed and watching what the Supreme Court has done should have been a sharp stick in which they said to associations who have refused to engage in a broader discussion about activism or advocacy, no more. We're not going to sit by and think that if we rattle our cup and make enough money in donations, we can right this wrong or we can turn this ship. So to me, that's one of those. The Supreme Court thing to me was exhibit A of how foolish we've been in our kind of placated sense of, you know, we're the independent sector and we do good work. We do. But dudes, we can do so much more.
So you mentioned, Robert, I loved that line, being an agent of the people. What does it take to be an agent of the people? What does that look like?
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons I always love social enterprise. You know, you make your own money, at least you've got a little bit of an edge. The nonprofit sector keeps growing. And in my opinion, at least, the pool of philanthropy is somewhat stagnant. It's not growing with the same level of the sector. You know, I've said this a couple of times recently, in fact, gone back to the math I did 20 years ago when I wrote Begging for Change, that the nonprofit sector in D.C., Washington, D.C., there were 26,000 nonprofits. And if the average wage of a CEO was 50 grand, that's 1.2 billion just to pay the CEO salaries. That's a lot of dough to come out of a town vis-a-vis philanthropy. So that idea of this many nonprofits slugging it out, I think social enterprise is, I've referred to it as economic Buddhism, you know, the middle path between .com and .org. But for those who do it, it can be a way that you can pay your team better and I think bring in I won't say better people, but I think keep people from starving, you know, while they fight the good fight. You could potentially hire an advocate or work with a variety of other nonprofits to maybe pool your assets and hire an advocate that will represent you collectively at the state house. So those are the kind of things that I think at least gave me a little bit more freedom than many, many have.
What do you see, Vu?
I think it's interesting. I think this might be where Robert and I may diverge in our opinions a bit, because I think social enterprise can be very good. And there's certainly some amazing ones. Over here in Seattle, we have cafes that are hiring people experiencing homelessness, single mothers, et cetera, and providing them with employment and things. So they can be really helpful. I guess I'm just a little skeptical when people are like, social enterprise would solve things and nonprofits need to do more, earn revenues. I'm not so sure that I really buy into that, because I feel like in some ways it doesn't always work, you know, for a lot of folks. I'm also thinking that maybe, you know, with capitalism being a cause for many of the issues we're trying to solve and using the principles of capitalism to try to solve these same issues caused by capitalism, it is something that I'm a bit skeptical about. And even like the ones that do have social enterprise, I mean, they still rely on a lot of funding from others. So I'm not so sure it's like a panacea for things. I guess I would lean more towards like really ensuring that rich people and corporations are paying their fair share of taxes.
And what does it take to do that? So we know it's a problem, and we know that if we leave that problem to the politicians, that nothing has happened. So yeah, what does it take to get that happening?
Well, I think it can't just be any government. It needs to be a representative government. And right now it's not. It's like mostly rich white dudes who cling on to power. So I think that we have to get like more progressive, like women of color to run. And I think once the government looks like the community and is invested in the community, because it's part of the community, instead of like people who are sort of peripheral to the community, you know, who live on the edge and they're gated communities or whatever, then I think that we can actually have some of these things that we need. And I don't know. I mean, talking again about the students, I think this is kind of what we need. We need this sort of revolution of like people just going out there, protecting voting rights, advancing more people running. I mean, this is kind of what people are terrified of. That's why over the past several years, like hundreds of voter suppression bills have been passed, because the politicians know that when people are voting and when they get elected, when they elect people who represent them and have their best interests in mind, then yeah, things certainly do change, and they're terrified of it. They're doing everything they can to stop that from happening.
To build a little bridge over to Vu here about, so, you know, again, let's. I want to go back for a second to social enterprise, because my take on it was not one individual programs earning money, even though, again, there is a validity to that. I'm a big believer in capitalism 2.0, that in effect you're using a version of capitalism, and you're showing that if a nonprofit, for example, can buy local, can hire people out of prison, can pay a living wage, can provide benefits, can reinvest in community, you've proven an economic principle. Now, my theory about social enterprise was the fact that when you look at, you know, Vu's generation and younger, there are 120 million people under 45 who are consumers. And if we could at least illustrate in a very provocative visual way, DC Kitchen was very visual. We got a lot of media, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to exploit that media, not for our own self-aggrandizement, but to say, hey, look, we're running a catering company, and look at all the value adds. You as consumers have power. And if you go back to whether it was Dr. King, who used the dimes it took to ride a bus in Montgomery, Alabama, if you look at Cesar Chavez, who took table grapes, if you took Mahatma Gandhi, who took the rupees it took to buy salt, what they showed is that if poor people's, even the most minuscule commerce, again, grapes, buses, salt, if poor people withhold, or better yet, redirect their money, the boycott was a powerful movement. It demonstrated that poor people's pennies have power. What I believe social enterprise, it heralds an era of the boycott, in which people make collective decisions about how they spend their money. And you coerce better behavior out of business by saying, if you want my, if an entire generation, if you want us to buy your products, this is the ante for our loyalty. We want an alternative to charity. We want you to pay a better wage. So to my way of thinking, social enterprise opens the doorway, at least, to a more interesting way to think about the power of everyday commerce.
What you're making me think about is the using the system against the system.
Booyah, booyah.
Because right now, this is the system we have. Until we blow up that system and create something that is more humane, that is more humane to planet and people, this is the system we have. And it is really interesting to consider what does it take to use that system to blow up the system.
If I may, just very quick, because I want to just riff on one other thing that Vu brought up, which is more people. You know, my entire career in the nonprofit sector, this has been the lamentation of every conference I've gone to. You know, at what point are we going to see more people of color, more women, or not more women, because our sector is feminized, but when are we going to see different people? And quite frankly, I thought for the longest time that poor people didn't view us as allies. Why would I join a sector that just continues to give me crappy food versus advocate for the wage I should be earning? But the theory was that as soon as we got women and people of color within leadership in the sector, things would change. And I think that idea of what is leadership, that's something that I would love to see our sector really dig deeper into. What does it mean to lead? The old model was, I get the parking spot out front, I get the biggest paycheck, I leave early, all those things. And that was a big part of my ongoing experiment, was how can I challenge those in my own work?
I appreciate that about the sort of the changing of leadership structures and philosophies here. And it's exciting to see that people are starting to experiment more with this. My last organization, for example, we were doing more of a distributed leadership type of model. I basically had a co-ED who was amazing, and they were in charge of the internal operations and everything, right? But then we also had this sort of decision-making process where I, as the ED, don't actually get any veto power. Whoever is in charge of specific areas, they have the final say in whatever it is, because they're the expert. Like, if you hire someone who has expertise in HR, why do you get to veto their decisions? Okay. So we were implementing that new sort of decision-making. When I left the organization split into four co-executive directors who each took on 50% of an ED's job. And then the other 50% they were focused on one particular other area, like operations or programming or whatever. And since an ED is like 200%, like, you know, two full-time jobs, it made sense. And it's been going really well. So I do think that this, what you were mentioning of this hierarchical structure, Robert, you know, with one leader on top of this pyramid or something, it's starting to kind of give way towards like shared leadership. And I think that's exciting. This sort of flatter hierarchy, I think that's just going to resonate more with younger people who just like, we don't understand. Why do you get to be on top of everything? Like, who gave you that authority? Like, we didn't.
Hildy, if you'll allow me one second to blow a little wind up Vu's proverbial skirt. Vu, I always thought your work.
I'd like to watch that. I'd like to watch that.
I don't think Vu gets enough credit. You know, I think the experiments you were doing in leadership there were really profound. And you wrote a lot about that. And I think many people know you for your brilliant wit. But I looked on with great curiosity and real respect for the experiments you did in leadership at your organization. So I think that's the kind of experimentation that I think our sector desperately needs.
Thank you, Robert. I appreciate it. Credit goes to the team, though. I was mainly the pretty face there, like the brilliant staff. there who did everything, and they're brilliant. And this four co-ED structure is still going strong years after I left the org. So it's awesome to see.
I think so much about the fact that if we focus just on the nonprofit sector, this sector was never designed with intent. This sector is a hodgepodge. The hierarchical structure comes right out of the military. The strategic planning comes right out of the military. The way we devise programs is rooted in thousands of years of church charity, where the religious institution decided who was deserving and served one person at a time, because they certainly weren't into systems change, because they were the system. So what do we do in program design? We decide who's deserving. We make them fill out applications. We serve one person at a time. And all the rest of what we have came out of the business world, from how we do marketing to how we do accounting, to the fact that, and so much of this makes me crazy, the fact that all of the good work we do is listed as an expense. So it is the asset we have to build on, but it's not shown anywhere on the balance sheet as an asset. It is only listed as an expense. And all of the stuff that we actually rely upon, the in-kind gifts of space and of somebody donating a van and of volunteers working 40 hours a week, it shows up nowhere. It shows up nowhere because our accounting model is a business model. And so all of these structures that we keep fighting against every single day in this Sisyphean struggle to push that rock up the hill, all of those structures, military, business, and church, came out of power and privilege. And we are somehow expected to dismantle power and privilege using the tools of power and privilege. And the degree to which I see conflict of interest inherent in every aspect of the work that we do, it's a big part for me of where I see the frustration coming from, is that we're pushing that rock up the hill because that rock was never intended to come down the hill.
I agree completely. But if you look at all three of those structures, they're run by men. I've spent 20 years speaking around our sector, trying different tactics to get the sector to maybe stop for a second and say, whoa, he's got a point. And I've tried lots of clever little things, but the last one that I really rode for a while, because I felt it was a revelation, was the fact that I believe our sector's independence, our liberation, is the last giant step for women. This is the feminized part of the American economy. 70% of our sector is led by, founded by, volunteered by, driven by women. And all the rules were designed to say, as long as you shut up and feed the poor, as long as you are meek and quiet and you behave, you'll get a little grant. And, you know, the point I've tried to make for a while is that we are now the third biggest employer in America, and you cannot make profit without our work. But we don't have the access to capital or the political power. And we've been told overtly after Citizens United, you know, corporations have First Amendment political rights akin to the individual, but nonprofits don't. Man, I'm a big F that guy when it comes. Now, again, it doesn't mean that our sector wouldn't or couldn't be polluted by politics. But for heaven's sakes, for us to sit out here collectively and try and charity our way out of some of these issues when we should have equal access to all of the resources that America could bring to bear. But that really does take electing a generation who doesn't view us as charitable do-gooders, but really that view us as part of a bold new economic vision that puts for-profit and nonprofit on the same level.
So then what does it take? What needs to be in place for that shift?
There's got to be a collective moment. How can we be involved and still respect the current line of demarcation between what nonprofits can or can't do? That doesn't mean, for example, I'll give you one of my favorites is Twitter, or X, allows you to self-identify I am Robert Egger. I am the president of this nonprofit, but this is my personal account on X. I can self-identify as a nonprofit leader, but I'm not jeopardizing my nonprofit status if I tweet or whatever you call it now that it's X. That collective power of 14 million people using social media in ways that don't jeopardize their organization's independence, but allows them to speak with a voice of a nonprofit leader, that has not been explored. And I think that is definitely worth a big, fat effort.
That's interesting, Robert. I do agree that we need to engage with politics more. We've been terrified of it. Funders have been underfunding 501c4s. They prevent 501c3s from doing advocacy work. I mean, literally, funders are like, you can't use this money for lobbying or advocacy work, even though nonprofits can spend up to 10% of their budgets to do precisely advocacy work. And it's been very frustrating, and I see this among like progressive leaning funders more, because I think the conservative leaning funders are pretty organized, right? They're like, yeah, go on in, you know, do whatever.
We want you to.
Right, exactly. And that's how they've been so effective.
Exactly. Right?
Another area that you and I may not always agree with is about like whether 501c3 should be able to endorse political candidates, which right now they can't. But I am firmly in the belief that we should have more 501c4s who are completely fine with endorsed political candidates, and they should be funded more, for sure. The other thing is, I guess I'm just afraid, you know, like I'm not opposed to nonprofits being political, like 501c3s being like fully political, like if we repeal the Johnson Amendment or whatever. I think the problem is that we have been so squeamish about being engaged that the other side would immediately weaponize this and be so far advanced. It's kind of like you're a cook, you know, like you have like a cooking competition. I watch a lot of TV like this is a lot of cooking competitions, right? And you have like two teams that are cooking, and you know, like one team is really all in on cooking, and you decide to throw them a new tool, like an immersion circulator. And it's like a brand new gadget that's really cool. Well, yeah, one team that's really into cooking is going to use that very effectively. The other team doesn't even believe they should be cooking. They're not going to do anything. They're just going to waste this gadget. Like, this is what happens. I think if we allow 501c3s to endorse political candidates or whatever, then what will happen is that the conservative organizations will totally use that even more effectively, because they've been so effective over the past several decades, even without that tool. And I just feel like we're still going to be wishy-washy about it. We're still going to just like, nah, we're just not there. This is not our place, blah, blah. We're above the fray or whatever. So I don't know. The political engagement, I do think progressive funders need to start funding, organizing a lot more. And we need to organize more. For sure.
You know, for your listeners, Hildy, I think it was in the mid, early 2000s. I don't know whether it's Urban Institute or somebody else, but they did a study basically saying what Vu just said is, you know, that conservative leaning foundations give multi-year grants, and they give people all the tools they need to go out and roar. Whereas progressives tend to give you nickels and dimes and make you come back and again say, here are the rules that you must play by. And I think what you've seen, in fact, it's interesting, Vu, because as you probably know, there were churches in the early, maybe 2010, 11, 12, that were trying to bait the IRS into challenging them. They wanted to go full in on the Johnson Amendment. And the IRS was like, we don't want to do this because we're completely unprepared for the mayhem. Again, you have to understand, the Johnson Amendment wasn't enacted to protect us from politics. It was enacted to protect politics from us. And we have stayed in this box. And for your listeners, I would just add the Johnson Amendment, we've tossed this around, was brought in 1954, 56, I should know. But basically, Lyndon Johnson, without hearing or testimony, in the dead of night, entered a little team, you know, a little rider on a bill that said nonprofits cannot be involved in partisan politics. They cannot endorse. It just coincidentally happened less than 40 days from Brown versus the Board of Education, where the NAACP, a nonprofit, worked with a Kansas-based church, a nonprofit, and they were organizing African-Americans within the church for their voting rights. I've always believed that Johnson, leading the Southern Dixiecrats was basically realizing that if the NAACP was allowed to use nonprofit churches to organize African Americans to vote, their grip on politics of the South was going to rapidly erode. And so this was a desperate attempt to stop the tide. And I wish we'd explored sometimes the roots of our segregation from politics, so we understood maybe how it came about and why it might not be as sacrosanct as we've been told.
The thought that's occurring to me, and if you want to talk about sacrosanct and heresy, that the only carrot that is dangled and the only stranglehold that the system has on us is tax exemption. In exchange for tax exemption, you will not fill in the blank. You will not do this, you will not do that, and you will not advocate for change in the government. There's this little part of me that says, okay, so what if that went away? So what if tax exemption went away? So much changes if tax exemption goes away. The way foundations operate, the way DAFs operate, the way we consider money, period. And the fact that in this capitalist society, money goes so hand in hand with our ability to create social change. And when change does happen, getting back to that beautiful phrase of the agent of the people, when change does happen, as we were talking earlier, it's movements that create the change. There's just something in me that says, okay, so if tax exemption went away, what does that lead to? What does that make possible for this whole sector, which would have to be completely redesigned because we are built around money and tax exemption and all of that dependency that that creates? But there's just something in my brain that says, ooh, this would be fun to play with.
I agree. It's an interesting supposition, but I would make sure the audience who's hearing us today understands that corporate America gets far more in tax benefits than we ever dream of. You know, we get, I think it's closing in on $1 billion a year that people give to charity, or $100 billion. I mean, it's a lot of dough that gets given by Americans to charity, but the amount of corporate welfare in America is so much greater. So the illusion that we have some kind of super benefit, I think it's just another one of these ridiculous, transparent canards. I would be interested, for example, you know, the only groups that are actually doing political work are churches, quite honestly. And that's in the Constitution, the separation of church and state. So I could see, for example, tinkering with the idea, and boy, I thank God I don't have a job anymore, because I know there's a whole bunch of your audience that would hate to hear the idea that houses of worship should maybe pay taxes. And as you probably know, the taxes that our government wants the most is property tax. We don't pay taxes. We pay payroll taxes, but property taxes is what we don't pay. And right now, most governments want universities and churches. They're red hot. That's what they want to tax. It's not the little donations we get. But if you want to play around, you want to have fun, I would say if you actually could elect a generation of people who looked at our tax code and said, okay, if you want to give money to a traditional, let's use a soup kitchen. I hate that word, but it's, you know, a food charity. And all they do is give away food. You can get a one-time tax deduction, rock and roll, same as it ever was. But if you choose to support a nonprofit that creates jobs, keeps people out of prison, we'll give you an annual tax deduction with increasing value based on the same rate of return principle as a dividend. It's basically an algorithm. If nonprofits could show how much they saved a community in recidivism, which is a massive amount of local economies, or how much money they brought into the community vis-a-vis art shows or 1,000 other things, imagine creating a way in which you could attain wealth, not necessarily from Wall Street, which is the one way now, besides property, that you would attain wealth. But imagine if you could invest in nonprofits and attain wealth. And imagine how that would spur a revolution in our sector of people demonstrating how their work made the community better, and how, you know, if you gave to them and rewarded those behaviors, again, creating jobs, keeping people out of prison, getting kids out of high school, there's a million different ways in which that could spur a revolution. And all it takes is somebody who would be willing to look at the tax code a little differently.
I know, Vu, you've been talking about just how people pay their taxes forever.
What I do appreciate about Robert is that you do bring up some perspectives that I oftentimes don't really consider. I don't always agree with. That's why it keeps our friendship spicy. It's great. I agree. And what I do love about your perspective is like bringing this economic, like what you say is like there is no profit without non-profit, which is a refrain that you say all the time, which I love. And I do think there needs to be more appreciation from the for-profit side on what non-profits bring and the strengths that we bring to the economy, right? That's something that you always bring up. I appreciate this sort of approach of being able to demonstrate our economic impacts. And at the same time, I'm trying to figure out how we can balance that with like the intrinsic value of the individual, because I feel like over the past several years, we've turned people in some ways into economic units, where it's kind of like, oh, well, if you help this one kid, then it's going to lead to this many economic. And I'm just like, can we just help the kid because it's the right thing to do? You know, it's like we kids just deserve to be helped. Old people deserve to have good meals, you know. I always joke that like a friend of mine, this actually happened, but she was like calling me up one day. I was like, I'm quitting the sector. And I was like, what? Why? What's going on? She's like, well, this program officer came to my senior hot meal program and was asking how many seniors we serve. And I said, we serve like 500 seniors a week with hot meals. And the program officer was like, oh, that's great. Well, that's like, it's like an output, but what are your outcomes? You know? And my friend's like, oh, well, you know, like it's 500 seniors go in hungry and they leave full. But of course, that's not the answer that they were looking for. We've been trained to think of like, oh, well, if you serve 500 seniors, they're less likely to fall and break their legs. And so they don't go to the emergency room. And so they save taxpayers money because, you know, they don't go to the emergency room. Crime rates have been reduced because hungry seniors are no longer robbing banks, so that save money in terms of police presence and jail time or whatever. And I'm just like, Jesus, like, we just help people who are hungry because they are hungry and we are in community together with one another. And so I understand the economic arguments that we have to make because that's the kind of world that we are in. But I would love for us to shift to kind of world where we don't have to justify helping people with economic units and what they bring to the economy in this very utilitarian sort of mindset of the world. Like, I would like us, maybe because I'm an idealist or whatever, or an optimist or whatever, but I'm like, you know, it'd be great if we just have a community that we just take care of each other, because that's just the right thing to do. And the other stuff, those are bonuses.
You know, I was asked again, I did a webinar last week and I was asked again. Basically, this is all well and good, but how do we measure success? Your point. Units of success. I heard somebody just today telling me a story about a federal grant that wanted to know how many units they served. I said, does that mean people? Yeah, they're talking about people as units served. And the thing that my answer to this person who wanted to know, you know, well, how do you measure success when what you're aiming at is not easily measured? And my answer is, can we please just stop measuring? We keep trying to metricize things that can't be metricized. I want a community that is humane and loving and healthy and equitable, and I can't put a number next to any of those things, because the things that matter in our lives, we can't put a number next to. And I'm really at the point of that, to me, is a conversation that we need to start having across this sector, which is, again, another business BS thing of it's units, it's numbers, it's dollars, it's how many dollars did we save? And again, to Robert's point, sometimes we have to work within the system to disrupt the system. And we have to show what the system is asking of us. And at the same time say, this is bull. I disagree with, you know, the political statement. I disagree with the premise of the question, that it's a false equivalency. years ago in my prior podcast, one of the people who came after you, Robert, in my interviews was Al Resgo, who at the time was the CEO of the New Orleans Community Foundation. And it was shortly after Katrina that I think it was the 5-year anniversary of Katrina that I was interviewing him. And we were talking about, and Al has been in philanthropy his entire life. He's been in the foundation sector his entire life. And we started to talk about measurement. We started to talk about, metrics. And he said, you know how I want to know how things have changed? I want to walk down the street and it looks like it changed. Period. And this BS requirement that we somehow metricize things that can't be metricized, which are the most important things in our lives. The most important things in our lives can't be measured. So if that's what our sector is all about, then that's one movement that we can change internally within us, which allows us to do better work out in the world if we are not constantly having to say, yeah, but how will we measure that? Years ago, I did a workshop for the Council on Foundations subgroup of community foundation leaders. And we were talking about community engagement and what it takes to bring community together and to work with other foundations on the issues that are of the most importance. And the one question people kept asking me is, yeah, but then how do we attribute that success to us? And it was like, just shoot me. You don't. Because if that's the thing that's the most important, or is the thing that's the most important that the community changed? And on that pivot of a note, I think we need to start wrapping up. And so I'm going to come back to, after our long and meandering conversation here, is there anything in particular that is standing out to you from our conversation when it comes to creating change? We've talked about so many things that will lead to change. Is there anything in particular that's standing out to you from our conversation today?
Well, if you'll allow me, I'd like to blow more wind up Vu's skirt.
Are you flirting with me, Robert? Okay.
Well, intellectually, you know, because I think each of us have tried to convey a different tactic, you know, a different strategy for how do we bust out of this. And coming up in my time, I was always trying to be hyper aware, and young leaders like Vu, in his both his writing and his personal style, and many others. Vu just happens to be in the room with us today. Help me understand, you know, whiteness and being a white man in our sector. And I was always hyper aware of the benefits I had being in Washington, D.C., very much right time, right place. But a lot of the abilities I've been able to bring and a lot of the different tactics, for example, that's because I had the time to think of this shit. I was right time, right place, and I had the swagger, the confidence of a guy born white in America. So there's a lot of things that I was able to bring because of that. But it also really probably in the mid early part of this century, what a weird thing to say. But in the early 2000s, start to think about my own role within DC Kitchen. How do I lead there? At what time is it important for a founder to leave? And all these other experiments, and it had a lot to do with my decision after LA Kitchen to stand down. I mean, dude, I could have kept working. I could have done things. But a lot of it was because I felt it was appropriate for more white dudes to kind of just say, I had a great run. I fucking had a ball. You know, I got to meet everybody. I got to write a book. I got to, you know, found and lead a great nonprofit and help others open similar kitchens. I'm done. You know, I think it's time for me to be an example, if you will, of saying I had a great run, but I'm just going to be a servant to another generation at this stage of my career. And I owe Vu and a lot of other people a lot of credit for helping me let go, because it isn't easy. You know, I think it's one of the things we should actually, the three of us should write a book, you know, how we started nonprofits and learned to let go. And we'll come to your conference and teach you how to do it, because it's not natural for leaders, CEOs to say, I'll split up the decision-making process. I don't have to be the highest paid employee. Your opinion is just as valuable as mine. Those are profound things that fly in the face of what most people are trained to think. But again, I just wanted to thank Vu, you, in particular, because I've always been inspired by you. This is just a long-winded way of saying to you and to many other young, powerful young leaders that I'm very grateful for the gentle exit you allowed me and the great ride you afforded me during my tenure in our sector.
Thank you, Robert. I really appreciate that. And I've been learning a lot from you and from our conversations over the past few years, from both of you, actually. It's really shaped the way that I've been thinking and doing things. You're sort of letting go. I remember one of our conversations we had a while ago, and I think it was maybe, I don't know, Philly or Denver or somewhere where we ran into each other. And you were mentioning the same thing, which is like, yeah, my role now is to support kind of younger leaders. And that's always stuck with me because I'm like, I'm also getting on in age. I mean, look at this white hair. I want to be gracious like Robert as I kind of thinking about the next generation of leaders because I am old now and I would like to make pottery and not to do with stuff. And so I always appreciate your perspective, Robert, and I'll be joining you in the old people leaders, servant leaders club soon. Hilde, just going back to your question, which is like, what do we do? What stuck out is, I think, again, going back to the students at Columbia and other places, we need to take lead from the anger, the righteous anger that's swelling up. We could be the people trying to repress this by adding snipers onto the roof or whatever and sniping at students trying to fight against genocide, or we can join them. And that's kind of where we should be. And I feel like there's already been lots of roadmaps for this, and they are created and well traversed by conservative movements. And we just need to kind of follow them, but like with our own progressive values. So I don't know. We need to just like go out there, be more political. We need to advocate more. We need to get more people elected who look like the community. We need to like reverse Citizens United. Sorry, Robert. Like I think for-profits just stay out of politics.
If we could do that, I'd be down. I'd be down for that.
Right. And we got to change the tax code. And I don't know. I mean, and also there's exciting things happening. I don't want us to dismiss that because it can get very hopeless and depressing otherwise. But there's awesome experimentation going on in the sector. There's some good things that are happening. There's more funders thinking about reparation, returning stolen indigenous land, making reparation for slavery. There's just more funders examining the roots of their wealth. There's more individual donors doing that. And I think it is really exciting. And I don't want us to be so mired in just the awfulness of the world because it is. It's really awful. It's really awful. But I take hope from the people who are organizing and the folks who are relentlessly out there trying to make change happen despite just the endless headwind. And we join them. That's what we do.
Awesome. Awesome. The thing that's striking me from everything that we've talked about is A, the deep need for systems change within the sector. We keep pointing to systems change out there in the world, the deep need for systems change within the sector, and that's going to be about the people. It's not going to be about the structures. It's not going to be about the taxes. It's going to be about the people themselves making it happen. And that's just so clear in everything that we've talked about is at every point that it's not just going to be about what nonprofits do. It's going to be about what people do in communities and what is our role in facilitating that. We've so much been taught that our organization, each and every one of our organizations, is the center of the universe. And we forget that we are a teeny, teeny, tiny piece in a universe that is our communities. And that's where change is going to happen. How can we serve as facilitators rather than thinking of ourselves as leading a movement? What if instead we're just helping the people who are already out there trying to fight the good fight?
Right on.
Thank you both so much for joining me. And I look forward to having y'all back and we can solve all the rest of it.
Right on.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robert.
I'm so grateful to Robert and Vu for sharing their ideas and their wisdom with us. If there's one thing that shines through from both of them, it's the love they feel for the people who work every single day to create a better world for all of us. The other thing both Robert and Vu make clear is that those of us working inside the social change ecosystem need to be constantly challenging the status quo. Because so many of the stumbling blocks along the road to true social change are not happening out there in the world. Those obstacles lie within the work of the social change ecosystem, and particularly the nonprofit sector itself. That, of course, includes the way social change is resourced, but it's more than that. It's about how we think about the work in the first place. And that's where the good news lies. Because those systems we all use to do our work, we can change them. So much of what Robert and Vu talked about is not a matter of law, but of habit. And I'm so grateful for the work they're both doing to make those habits visible so that we can make the necessary changes towards a more humane, equitable, and loving world. You'll find more information about the work Robert and Vu are both doing at the description page for this podcast. And while you're at that podcast page, if this episode got you thinking, we hope you will subscribe. Our guests are guaranteed to energize and inspire you. And in times like these, we need all the energy and inspiration we can get. Thank you for being with us today and for wanting to create a better future for our world. We'll see you next time here at Creating the Future.